Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 123 featuring Aaron Sims of Aaron Sims Creative, which is kind of an awesome person to have on, won't you say, Alan?
Yeah, amazing work. Those guys do just the craziest stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And so I was lucky enough not only to be able to go check them out, but to talk to Aaron himself, who has... considering he's probably about my age, just the legacy behind him is incredible, right? So we're talking about a guy who's worked in the film industry for a long time. And he started doing his first illustrations in L.A. when he was 19 years old. And he worked at Rick Baker Studios for 12 years. I mean, think about that, right? You know, yeah. That is a major, major player in the world of practical effects, right? And there was a transition moment that he saw into the digital world that most other people in that industry were sort of fearful of. And he saw that as something positive. And I think that's what differentiated him in a lot of ways from what's going on. And he talks about it in the podcast. I don't want to spoil it too much, but he did end up going work at Stan Winston, and the work he did at Stan Winston's workshop was pretty, pretty amazing. And that's obviously another big place until he sort of started his own thing and doing his own studio. And the approach that he's taking to that studio is also very interesting because they do something unique where they try to bring their flavor from the very beginning, right?
Yeah, I mean, Aaron and his team have had a huge hand in the look of a lot of different characters and,
exactly.
and a lot of different film, television.
From the beginning.
From the very beginning, from the concept art through
right.
you know, to the final end screen.
And obviously Stranger Things is a perfect example of that.
Yep.
And Stranger Things is a big deal.
The right? Demogorgon, am I saying that right?
Yeah, I think so.
that's a spooky looking creature.
Yeah, and that was a lot. We talk about that a lot, obviously. But they call that whole thing, I think this is pretty much like almost like a copyrighted term to them, right? They call it from sketch to screen, right? Where they start with the sketch, and that's at the earliest stages, and they carry that all the way through to the final image on the screen.
It should be from sketch to scream.
Good one. I like it, Lon.
I'm patenting that. Trademark.
Well, yeah, well, they trademarked the other one, so that's good. But yeah, no, it's a really cool thing. And what's also interesting is they started talking a lot about education as well. And near the end of the podcast, we talk about some of their education initiatives that they're trying to do. And Aaron got a little bit into it, but couldn't quite give you too much detail. So they told me that they still can't quite tell you much, but what they're basically doing is going to be a completely immersive masterclass into their workflow. So you'll be able to know exactly what they're doing. And this will be for, you know, either a few days or a week, or I'm not sure exactly what the schedule will be, but it'll be taught at their studio. So you would go to Aaron Sims Creatives and actually learn what they're doing and sort of have that understand, you know, their exact workflow. It'll be coming out sometime in the summer or fall. And if you want to know more about it, you should definitely go to their website and follow them there, as well as all of their social media. So I will put links. Go to our podcast page and check out all the links on there for all of their social media. But you should look up, apparently, the ones you should specifically look are like Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn. But apparently they have a pretty creative or big YouTube channel. So they should check out their YouTube channel and their Instagram as well. And you'll get more information about all that stuff there. So go check it out. It was really great talking to them. And I really was happy to sort of be part of it. What is your favorite part of Stranger Things?
Well, I mean, for me, and we were just talking about this earlier, is the nostalgia part of it.
Yeah.
Right? Like there's... it looked exactly like the neighborhood I grew up. And I kind of actually misread my BMX bike around all day, every day.
Yep, me too.
So that was one of the, you know, we never got to like run in with aliens or anything. So we kind of
No, but you
part,
wish you but, did, didn't
yeah.
you? Yeah.
So that to me was one of the coolest parts about it. But I think overall just the how well developed the characters were, how kind of lovable the characters were, that you yep. actually cared about them. Which is a rarity, I think, in a lot
but
of
I think
different
was,
television shows.
It got so deep in terms of the weirdness of it, right? It was it was more than just a spooky monster that was hiding in the closet,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It was funkier than that. It was a weird aesthetic. It was a total, it did, while it's cool to be nostalgic about it, and I'm going to go into this a little bit at some point with Dan Thrawn and I, but it's good to be nostalgic, but it's also good to have a break from that and be a little bit stranger than that, which is why it's called Stranger
right.
Things. You know,
yeah. For the story to stand on its own.
Yeah. And so that is a creativity that was behind there. And the look of that was really good. And I know that Aaron and his group of people had a heavy part in that. And so that's what I think was really cool. I think that... The other thing that was really cool is all the decisions that they made. This is from Aaron, right? He's worked for Rick Baker and he worked for Stan Winston and he's done the digital thing and he's done everything. So he's not automatically go to the computer because that's what he knows how to do. He knows everything, right? So if it needs to be practical, it's going to be practical. So all the decisions they made were based on logical choices of aesthetic and economic choices. And that he had a heavy part in that because he is someone that understands all that stuff. So it's really cool to talk to him. All right, guys. Hopefully you enjoyed the podcast. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're going to fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
All right, well, I'm glad we finally were able to figure out a schedule that I could come down here. And I'm really glad I was able to do it in your office to check out the things going on.
Oh, yeah. No, I appreciate you coming in.
Yeah, it's really cool. There's obviously just a long history that you bring to this place. And foster creativity. But I think it'd be good, since my audience is fairly wide and may not necessarily know, a lot of people will know exactly who you are, but some people may not. So can you tell them a little bit about your background, like where it came from? And obviously you were showing me some Polaroids. Are you doing films when you're in seventh grade with your buddy? And
how far do you want me to go back?
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously you're always interested in film. And I think a lot of people were interested in that as well. Were you doing like, were you basically like the kids from 8mm who were doing creature films?
Yeah, that film was us. It was we had actually a couple other friends, and so it's like we knew who each person was based on that film.
So right.
So it was interesting to see. It was like living our life again through this film. JJ, obviously, I think he's same age, so he kind of comes from the same thing. I mean, obviously, a lot more successful as a director and producer, but. But, he's that same, background of like, we didn't have video or phones or, just the Super 8 was, pretty much the only way of making a movie, back then. And luckily, my dad had a Super 8 camera that we could actually rewind so we could do superimposing images on top.
Those are harder to find.
They are, yeah. but early on, I was always into the visual medium of not only as a illustrator, a designer, a sculptor, drawing all the time, but making movies and doing effects. So it was way back then. It was one of those that I think it allowed for patience too. There was all this this not instantaneous gratification.
Yep.
So when you were actually would film anything with the Super 8. Then you would have to wait, bring it in, get it developed, and wait, a week or so before you've even seen it to see if it actually, was the lens on or, did I get it? A lot of times actually it was just all horrible. It was like all learning experience, which was actually fun because then we thought, the next time we'll do it this way.
Right.
Like we played with stop motion, claymation, all that fun stuff.
Right.
Early, when we were like, young kids, that was our fun really is.
It taught you patience, right?
It did take, I mean, that was the one thing as I realized early on too. There were certain things in my childhood that I was always interested in, and stop motion, I was so enthralled by Ray Harryhausen that, just seeing, Jason the Argonauts and, Clash of Titans, any of his brilliant stop motion films that he created were such an inspiration. And it wasn't until actually I got behind the camera and tried to have the patience of, you know, doing stop motion, I realized, okay, I don't have the patience for this.
Right.
It's one of those that the way I am as a creative, I do like a little bit more instant gratification. So
sure.
The one thing of like, you know, filming something and having to wait for it to develop was as far as I could, you know, wait.
Okay.
But sitting there and having to slowly move a model, you know, piece by piece and thinking, is this far enough? Is it not? Then, you know, I realized that's not my talent.
Right.
There's it gave me more respect for Ray Harryhausen and now, you know, Phil Tippett and all these people that, you know, have created incredible stop motion characters that they really understand, you know, when they're doing it, what that motion is early on. And that's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
My dad was an animator. He worked for, unfortunately, it's not necessarily unfortunate, but it wasn't, I don't think, a creative outlet for him. And I think what he would like is it was a military company that needed, this is before computer graphics.
Okay.
So it was all cell animation. And it was, you know, during the, you know, Cold War. Creating, things for the military that they actually had ideas and they'd get funding from the government. And
sure.
So he would bring that stuff home and he had his own studio. And occasionally I would just use it for creating my own stuff, like, you know, monsters or whatever coming to life. But at one point I realized, you know, early on that it wasn't, again, for me, I think it was that having to be redundant and do the same or just slight variations.
Right.
And gave me, again, more appreciation for cell animation and animators and what they have to achieve. So all these, you know, as a kid, you know, figuring out all these things that I was exploring and had the opportunity to, you know, from having a camera, a Super 8 that I could mess around with, to...
having your dad as well.
Yeah, right? And having my dad, that was an inspiration. I found other things, film was still always an interest, but drawing and creating and doing paintings and sculpting was always an interest as a young child. So, I, you know, started doing variations on, you know, my own interpretation of like Star Wars as paintings, as Planet of the Apes, the original with Charlton Heston, would do all these oil paintings and, you know, kind of learned to how to paint. And luckily I had a mentor at the time that was also the same friend that I was doing the Super 8 films with.
Yeah.
And his father was an illustrator. His name was Don Ivan Punchatz.
Okay.
And he was a well-known sci-fi book cover illustrator.
Okay.
He did the original Foundation books.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I love those books.
Yeah, so he did the covers for those.
Those are great.
Yeah, so there was a lot of the, you know. So he was an inspiration. So I was surrounded, you know. And this is living in Texas, where, you know, in Arlington.
Where in Texas were you?
Arlington, which is kind of it's in between Fort Worth and Dallas.
Yep.
It's, you know, in the suburbs, and there wasn't much to do except for, you know, having a friend that had a similar interest. And luckily having, you know, my father as an inspiration and my friend's father that was, you know, a well-known illustrator.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like I had, you know, early on nice guidance as far as, creative outlets.
Right.
And I was able to explore a lot of those. It was right after high school, I left Texas and moved out to California.
Okay.
Focusing mainly as illustrating, being an illustrator, because the realism of getting into the film industry at that time was it didn't seem realistic to me, you know, to just spend time, because I didn't know anyone.
Right.
But I did know, how to actually go about, based on Don Ivan Punchatz giving me some advice, what schools to go to in California, as well as, what places to actually look into as far as doing illustrations. The school aspect was kind of tough for me because I really didn't have the funds to, when I first moved out here, to afford it. But I did get, you know, a couple of illustration jobs right off the bat, and one of them was for Penthouse. And it was for venereal warts, but it was a sci-fi image. It was a spaceship.
Cool.
It was a spaceship.
Barbarella-ish.
Yeah, exactly. A spaceship in the shape of a penis that had like these shapes on them that were being lasered off by some other spaceship.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, at least I was able to be a little bit in my sci-fi realm, but the topic was a little kind of odd.
Uh-huh.
And also just, that wasn't my dream to be doing the illustration for Penthouse. Nothing against Penthouse at all, but it's just I kind of had higher hopes. For like, book covers.
We've all had those. I mean, I was talking to Tim Miller, over at Blur, and one of his first directing job was, so you have a venereal disease.
Yeah.
And those first jobs are not like necessarily the ones, but they're fun to think about. It's like how much you've come from those things, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But you were illustrating at this point, right? So you did this right out of school. You hadn't gone to school yet, right?
Yeah, it was really, being 19.
And being paid to do it.
Yeah, being paid. And It wasn't much, but it was, it was enough that I felt like, this is, could I make a career out of doing this? And it's like, the hardest thing is I didn't have an agent or a manager. So it was like, how do I find that work?
Right.
And I needed more of a full-time job. And I was living in West Covina, which was close to a Tower Records, which doesn't exist anymore.
Okay.
But
yeah.
But they needed like some illustrators for their windows and their displays, and
And
so I started doing that, that was a little bit of a creative outlet, and it was some income.
Yeah.
But then I got a call less than a year, and it was from my high school friend that we did Super 8.
Yeah.
Greg Punchetz. Mm-hmm. And he was working on Elm Street 2.
Nice.
And
so how did he get in? I guess he got here a little bit before you and started getting into it.
He did. He actually had a lot of ins because he was focused on being a makeup effects artist.
Uh-huh.
And so he was always connecting with people that were either from Texas that had moved out to California that were
right.
working.
Yep.
So he had his in, and one of them was this guy named Bart Mixon. Mm-hmm. Another was like Mark Sjostrom, mm-hmm. and that's who he was working for at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they were finishing up on Elm Street, and he asked me, he goes, hey, we're about to work on this H.P. Lovecraft film called From Beyond, mm-hmm. and it has a lot of creatures, and we grew up together, and you're always drawing creatures, and there's no one here that does that. Would you be interested in just kind of coming in and helping out? And I said, of course.
Right.
So once I got there and I started, designing and left Tower Records, and now I'm feeling like, okay, this is more exciting to me because it was something I dreamed of as a child, but I wasn't, I was trying to be realistic about my goals, and now I'm in. So what else do I do from here? So Mark Sjostrom, that was running the show, asked me if I could sculpt and mold, and it was all the things that you had to do and learn being a makeup artist, which was a makeup effects artist, which was creating prosthetics for actors or puppets or anything else. And I said, I have a little bit of skill there, but I didn't have much. So I started doing it, and I learned very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the learning came from just the enthusiasm, I was a sponge at the time because this was so exciting.
Yeah.
So it was like any information, like, tell me what do I have to do here? So I started learning real early.
But any opportunity to do creature, makeup effects is just...
Yeah.
And it's kind of a little bit of a lost art sometimes these days.
It really is. It's sad, but, I actually... as far as my personality it goes, is that I'm always into new things and changing. Mm-hmm. As long as I don't have to completely start from scratch, creativity is always there. If it's an art form and I can find a new tool to create my art, then I'm excited about it. Because there is, after a while, and I jump ahead, as I was in makeup effects for almost 30 years.
Yeah.
It did get stagnant for me.
Okay.
From Beyond, it was Evil Dead 2, it just kept, other opportunities. There was Fright Night 2, there was Gremlins 2, there was a lot of sequels.
Yeah, a lot of twos.
Yeah, a lot of twos. But
right.
But Gremlins was an exciting one because that's when I was first hired to work at Rick Baker's, the Academy Award winning Rick Baker.
I mean, that's huge.
He was one that growing up and seeing American Werewolf in London, and I realized, if I could do that, that would be great. And that's really what that my friend Greg Punchetz was really focused on. He, like when we were younger,
Right.
He actually did some prosthetics on me and a bunch of other people and was in contact with Rick and all these other talents out here in California that were doing makeup effects. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I was pretty happy. I was pretty excited because I met Rick Baker's, you know, this icon.
Legend,
and, legend icon in the industry. And, you know, working on Gremlins, and I was, you know, hired on to design some of them, but mainly be the painter, like painting a lot of the skins and the puppets, you know, from all the characters to, you know, to Gizmo and the other characters, you know, coming up with, you know, techniques for their eyes. You know, it was a really exciting time for me.
Yeah, because now you're doing robotics and stuff in a sense, right? Or puppetry. That's complicated.
Yeah, the puppetry wasn't really... I was more on that creative part. So there's mechanics around that.
The eyes have to look right, right?
They have to, yeah. Right. Yeah. But it was a lot of fun. You know, it was exciting. That was a long project. That was one of the longest projects that I've worked on for a while, at that time at least, which was over 2 years. And then we worked on, you know, Men in Black and a bunch of other, like the Nutty Professor, and I was doing prosthetics for that. And Men in Black, I was doing the aliens. I designed the little worm guys that were drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that was a fun one because that one, that particular job and project was really exciting to me because of the fact that I'm most comfortable in sci-fi. I love horror, but I think sci-fi allows for me to really be creative.
Right.
You know, come up with, you know, what an alien can be. What can you do? It's endless, really,
right,
as far as the creativity. But I mean, it could be like, you know, completely non-human and very abstract. As long as you can create a personality that comes through that, you know, you understand.
Right.
I think it could be successful. But that one allowed for me and many of the other people at Rex to be extremely creative. And it was a fun film. You know, there was a lot of humor. So you could go humorous with the designs and the characters and add a lot more personality. And that particular character, the worm guys, were kind of an afterthought. There was a lot of main characters that were written into the script at the time. And then there was all this, like, let's design a bunch of background characters.
Right.
So I designed a bunch of the background characters as well, but worked on this one that really resonated with Barry Sonnenfeld, the director. And I did it as a maquette, which a maquette is, you know, a miniature version of what it's going to be, or a sculpture.
Right.
It's kind of a rough idea.
It's a small sculpture.
It's a small sculpture. And it was around, like, you know, I did it around 2-3, actually about 3 feet tall. I wanted it to be, you know, enough that you could see the detail in it.
Right.
The director came in and saw it and loved it and said, hey, I want to make a story, a whole scene out of this, guys.
Right.
And I already had an idea. I already kind of like figured out, like, these guys were going to be 7 feet tall and all the, you know, these different ideas, what they're going to do. And he was like, no. Actually, I like the size that you sculpted. That's what they're going to be. And
so funny.
Yeah. And and I'll come up with something. Maybe you can help with it. So I started thinking about stuff too. So I did some Photoshop at the time. This was early Photoshop days you know, taking my sculpture and splicing it into her kitchen because he had said, maybe it's a kitchenette scene or something like that. So then I started posing him and putting him in that scene. And that was pretty much, you know, it was in the film. So it was kind of exciting to be a part of that on multiple levels. You know,
just, it's funny that you say that because now that you've told me the story, I can see how those were just an added character.
Yeah.
But they're so memorable. Like, they're like really, really memorable because the story was so funny and everything else. Obviously, they don't have a specific timeline in the actual story that is necessary.
They don't,
but
really.
But they are hilarious. And it's just that the revelation of them, and then just they continue to like interject throughout the whole process.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They were really great. They were really great.
Yeah. It was a pleasure to work on, and it was a really exciting time. But again, after a year, that was a few years or several years of being in the industry and, you know, kind of feeling like, okay, is this, you know, what I'm going to be doing for makeup effects?
Right.
I have a tendency with myself not to completely get bored, but I want more.
Okay.
You know, so, and I think that when that came along, it was the right time where I felt like, okay, I'm getting more out of this on a creative level.
Right.
And being a part of something that, you know, that I had fun with, but also luckily I think a lot of other people did when they saw it. And it is interesting because it is, does, they're not an important part of that story at all. They're not, they're just kind of a, you know, just a character that are like you walk by and you, you know, they have, a,
yeah,
you know,
but they're great,
but they are rememberable, which is good.
They're very memorable. I mean, the minute you say that, it's like, I just see, I know exactly the shot with them, the coffee and the pouring and the cigarettes and all that stuff. But I also love the fact that you, just what you were talking about, the sci-fi story that offers you more creativity. Because you made the maquette that's 3 feet tall, if that was a horror film or whatever, it would have to be human size, right?
Yeah.
And there, when it was sci-fi, it's like, no, this could be 7 feet tall, could be 15 feet tall, could be 2 feet tall. So it's really cool that that was sort of... But do you feel that that was the first project where you felt like you contributed to the story through these characters in a way?
I did. You know, there's a lot of times working on films, a lot of the story and characters and... the creatures are already thought of, you know, we're, as a designer, as, you know, from even what I'm doing now, but is that a lot of those ideas are just to enhance what's already there. So that was a really fun time, and project because it, I was able to contribute on a level that, you know, became an iconic character that wasn't really even in the script originally. Because it was something, I guess, to, from the eyes of the director that it was, you know, necessary or, you know, something like this in the film. So being a part of that, you know, allowed me to really feel like, okay, I can enjoy this process if there's more opportunity like this. Because part of it, the, where the enjoyment is lacking in a way, as for myself, I can't speak for anyone else, but it's just the redundancy of the industry where it's like you feel like you're a machine and you can't contribute. Even on the creative level, like it's like many times we'll design stuff, create stuff, and we're only, you know, trying to, you know, kind of be a puppet for someone else. And that's not very fulfilling. It's not necessarily a bad thing. And you know, a lot of times, you know, it's, you look at it, it's just a job. But as artists and as, you know, creators, you know, we want to contribute more as if we can. So that opportunity was great, you know, and I, you know, and there's not too many like that that happen, you know. It's changed quite a bit now as I've, you know, grown and I've become, you know, kind of my own entity and company and recognized because a lot of, some people will ask early on, hey, can you help with this idea? You know, I'm have a very vague idea and we're starting to write the script. Can you take this, you know, this idea and add to it? So that actually has changed in the last several years. And I think it's one thing that's happened recently is it become more of helping in that process of pitching to the studios and to investors, you know, with directors and producers that have either an option of a book or a story that they have that they need visuals. And that's, you know, where it's changed. I kind of went forward right there, but
I know, and I want to get there because I think, I mean, I was just given a tour of your studio, right? And I was given a very concise way of understanding that process, which I want to talk about because I think there's a lot of parallels between what you guys do creatively with other groups creatively that are not necessarily done in the film industry, right? The film industry is very segmented in a lot of ways in terms of what it does, and you guys are trying to bridge a lot of gaps. But I think there's a lot of things going on in there. But before we get too far on that, I want to make sure we know a little bit more about your history of how you ended up getting to here where you did found founded this company and do what you want to do, because I think there's a lot of these stories that from your past that that enabled that thought of like, now that I have my own company, this is how I want to do it, right?
Yeah, it's true.
So what you were at Rick Baker's for how long?
12 years.
12 years. That's great. Did you know Dan Platt?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I worked with him as well.
He was Dan's great.
Yeah. He's an amazing guy. He worked with me at Digital Domain when we were doing some digital human work and all that other stuff. And one of the things about him, and I know it comes from that background that's similar to you, is he knew more about anatomy in terms of every muscle in your face and your body and everything than anyone I knew. So if something looked wrong and I couldn't quite figure out why, I could just go to Dan. It's like, what's wrong? He's like, well, her muscle here is not exactly correct. And so I know that the act of sculpting or the act of actually working in real 3D teaches you something that it gives you another sense, right? Because you can see with your eyes on a computer, but when you're sculpting, you can feel it. And if it doesn't feel right, that's an extra sense that helps you.
Yeah, it's so true. Yeah, and now Dan is extremely talented. And,
yeah.
And yeah, the knowledge in that is so important. You know, having the knowledge, especially as, you know, creature creators or character creators, understanding anatomy and is so important. And it's something that is somewhat forgotten a lot of times. A lot of artists will say, well, I'm making a creature, I can do anything. But without the fundamentals or the understanding of anatomy, then a lot of it won't make sense.
You know?
How is it going to move? How is it going to support itself? You know, weight, balance, all that stuff.
Exactly.
And that's the greatest thing. I think I learned a lot from being at Rick Baker's and a lot of these other incredible artists, you know, just being surrounded by talented artists. Because, you know, I like I said, when I first moved out here, I was going to go to school. Mm-hmm. I never did. My school was the movie industry.
Right, learned on the job.
Yeah, and that's, in some ways, that's the best. I mean, there's a lot of things I wished I did learn.
Sure.
And I started taking classes here and there. When I was at Rick's, I was going to the Art Center and taking, you know, some anatomy classes and also life drawing, kind of nights and weekends. So I felt like, you know, I was gaining a little bit more stuff that I felt like I needed to explore as an artist. But it was around the 90s. Mid-90s when Jurassic Park came out, and that's where a light to me, you know, or almost like this feeling of when I was a child and, you know, playing with the stop motion or any of this stuff, or getting in the film industry doing makeup effects, I felt like, okay, this has rejuvenated this kind of youth and my creativity that I feel like I want to learn this.
Right.
It was way beyond anything I could imagine because it was so technical.
Uh-huh.
But it was that movie, and I'm sure it inspired so many others, is that, you know, what was done at ILM, you know, what Phil Tippett did with the stop motion and Dennis Muren and everybody over there that created like this incredible, you know, this collaboration of like, you know, abilities to create, you know, these such rememberable, even now, dinosaurs that stand out.
I actually did a podcast with Steve Spaz Williams and Mark DePay, who did the first CG dinosaurs, right? And so them talking about how the differences and all these things learned from Tippett and those guys.
Cool. I mean, the choreography of what Tippett put together, I think just, I'm sure, helped out, you know, in the process.
Oh, absolutely. What I think is so great about it, and also what Stan Winston was doing as well, is that it was so good on all sides that you can't tell which one is which.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that just speaks well to the entire process.
That was such an exciting breakthrough, you know, I think for the industry in the effects industry. I think it was scary for a lot of makeup effects, you know. I mean, I was at Rick Baker's at the time, and we all went out. He actually took us, so we all went to the movies to go see it, and almost everybody, I think, was depressed afterwards.
Because they thought they were that practical was going to go away.
Yeah, and I was looking at it like, this is exciting. This is, a new adventure. Mm-hmm. You know, something I could bite my teeth into, and all the complications and the things that I couldn't do physically, now I can do if I can just learn this tool, you know. And I could maybe do it all, you know. It's like I think about, like, when it was puppets, you know, I wasn't a mechanic, so I had to give it to the mechanics to really buy all, you know, build all the hydraulics and everything else. And all the other technical aspects and weight and everything else that comes along with building something giant.
Right.
Stan Winston, it was, you know, what he was able to achieve in the animatronics.
Right.
I can't even speak right.
Yeah.
Now. Animatronics.
Yeah.
So, there you go. was mind blowing. It was like, I think the combination of both ILM and Stan was just, you know, a good marriage at the time of those two working well together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, for myself, I was inspired. I tried to find out what software they were using.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one was Softimage and the other one was Power Animator.
Yeah.
Alias Power Animator.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to get my hands on a Softimage license and do as much as I could with whatever was out there. There was a couple of like little videos here and there.
So limited.
It was so limited. But I told myself, and what I did, and this is what I do with all my, when I want to learn something.
Yeah.
And I tell my artists the same thing, is give yourself a project. You know, don't learn it just to learn it, because right. you won't remember it.
You'll just make a cube and that's about it.
Yeah, and you'll get frustrated. Yeah. But if you tell yourself, and I had at that time, is like, hey, I have this gargoyle idea, story I want to make, and I couldn't physically do it. So this mm-hmm. is the only way I could do it is with animation, if I could only figure out how to use these tools. And I didn't know anything about it.
Right.
So I started teaching myself, you know, learning, reading any books that were out there about just the basic idea of like how to build a 3D model.
Right.
You know, and I slowly learned, and I think I got to a place where I actually did have a gargoyle that had some animation on it, but right. it was, at that time, it was just so limited right. for my knowledge in it
right.
that I couldn't achieve what I wanted, but it got me to that hurdle of understanding.
Right.
And that was the most important thing for me at the
time. But I bet you at the time there wasn't that many people doing things like you were doing at all, right?
No, I don't think there was. It was I mean, obviously a digital domain was starting up, all that
sure.
stuff. There was, and there was, you know, other, you know, ILM and.
But the roster of artists doing this was probably low enough that when you start doing stuff like this, you'll get someone's attention no matter what, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you're going to, and what I like about that is when you're at the beginning of the new technology, right? Mm-hmm. People are like, oh, well, it's just the beginning. It's not there yet. So I'm going to wait a couple of years. No, no, no. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Do it now, because now is your chance to influence that industry.
Oh, yeah.
Ways.
Yeah, there's a, it was a few years. It was like four, it was probably about 5 years. It was almost 2000. I was, Rick was taking a break from the industry. I was continuing to work on my visual effects skills uh-huh. and animation, and started to put together a reel
right.
and thinking, okay, I'm going to, now there's like a couple, you know, these companies that are out there, there's Digital Domain. There was, you know, Rhythm and Hues. There was a few like that were, that had popped up yep. that were like, okay, these are places maybe I should start looking, or go to ILM if mm-hmm. I can. It's such a small industry that immediately that when Rick that same day said, hey, I'm going to take a break. You know, we had been there for 12 years. None mm-hmm. of us had taken a break. Mm-hmm. He was going to say, hey, you know, I'm going to take a little break. I'm probably get back into it. So he basically had everyone like take off, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I got a call from Stan Winston
right.
saying, hey, I heard that you have a lot of fans over here and some friends, and you know, I'd like to meet with you and interview you.
Uh-huh.
And I said, that sounds fantastic. I'm a huge fan of yours. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of making my way out of makeup effects.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, oh, what does that mean? And they go, well, I'm, you know, more interested in visual effects. And he goes, well, let me see what you have and let's talk.
Mm-hmm.
Since he was one of the founders of Digital Domain
yeah.
with James Cameron.
Yeah.
So I met with him. He was impressed with all my work. And he said, you know what? I've been thinking about doing this for a bit. Digital Domain is, you know, kind of its own thing. It's bigger. But I want right. something small in-house that we can kind of start. Maybe you're the perfect person to lead this.
Oh, that's awesome.
So started this thing called SW Digital.
Mm-hmm.
And
Stan Winston Digital.
Yeah, Stan Winston Digital. And there was yep. a few people that were brought on, because I told them, it's like, you know, I have very limited knowledge in this. I have right. an incredible interest, but I've never run anything like this. I don't, yep. you know. So we started looking for people to help, and there was a couple of people from Digital Domain at the time, Andre Bastanaby uh-huh. and Randall Rosa,
uh-huh.
That were going to run it with, you know, with me as the lead, mm-hmm. Art director and, you know, kind of a creative director.
Mm-hmm.
Even before they started, we had the computers, we had Softimage, we had, you know, it was extremely expensive at the time. It was, I forget what it was.
It was like 50 grand.
Yeah, something.
For one license.
Yeah. Yeah. And the machines weren't that cheap.
And the machines were like another 50 grand.
Yeah, so we had two machines. Because I, you know, I basically was able to find out enough information about what the needs were,
mm-hmm.
Get the stuff set up and have Softimage. And then this project started up right when these computers arrived, and it was Steven Spielberg's AI.
Oh, yeah.
And Stan had worked with Steven on almost all his projects. So it was one of those that where I started to do some sketches. He said, hey, I want you to design some stuff.
Uh-huh.
I spent like a couple of days. Stan saw the designs and said, hey, these are great. We'll send them to Steven. Steven liked one of my sketches. Uh-huh. ILM was also designing two kind of very traditional sketches using mm-hmm. Photoshop here and there. Stan comes in and goes, hey, you know, Steven likes this design that you did, this sketch. Yeah. I don't want you to sketch anymore. I want you to use these computers, these animation computers, you know, Softimage to create these designs. I go, you know, these are animation programs. They're not for designing.
Right.
Because no one at that time, this is, you know, was
there wasn't
really...
There ZBrush, right?
Yeah, there was no ZBrush. There was nothing. It was like, okay.
It's a hard thing.
It was all NURBS at the time.
Oh,
so.
God, the pain.
Yeah. So it was like, so then it was these, the robots he had me design were the ones at the end, which everyone I think thinks are aliens.
But they're right, actually... They're evolved robots.
Yeah, they evolved robots 2,000 right. years in the future. So we started working on those, and I started experimenting. And I realized, you know what, this is kind of a cool tool. It's like, especially for this type of thing I'm designing, it's like I can do this fairly quick. Mm-hmm. Now that I understand, you know, what the design is, how I'm going to achieve it, and then since it was NURBS, there was which is, you know, these. I don't want to go into the technical aspect for you know your listeners because they're going, what is
look
NURBS?
Look up NURBS, N-U-R-B-S, and you'll know the pain that was.
Yes. But NURBS, you know, had this interesting way of like, you know, creating its own like UVs in some ways.
Where it was a nice way to look at it as patches.
Yeah, yeah.
And as such, it was more practical in some ways, especially for creatures mm-hmm. at that time compared to what polygons were, because it was painful to UV things in polygons.
Yeah, yeah. Polygons were very limited. Right. This is probably getting really boring for everyone right now.
No, it's good. It's good.
But the fun thing that I was able to do with this, that because of these NURBS and because it was easy to texture in a lot of ways, I could experiment with things. Mm-hmm. And since it was a robot that was like, basically, 2,000 years in the future, and they're, you know, basically growing themselves. They weren't necessarily mechanical looking in a lot of ways. I could experiment with anything I wanted. So this allowed me to go on the internet, find different things, like, okay, what if I put this a different skin on it? Like, you know, what about the, a light on a car, something like that, like the headlight of a car that actually has a pattern on it. Maybe they'll do something interesting. Right when I put that on, it wrapped itself around the entire design, and I was blown away. I was like, this is so complicated, but intricate and original and different.
Right.
And there's a translucency. There's all these things
and
I
you
want.
You can change things so quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Like the texture, like, oh, let's try a different texture. Let's try a different look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the thing is it became in some ways, I found it like an accidental creative process mm-hmm. because I could just throw things, not thinking about like I don't care what the results are going to be. I'm just going to throw it on, see what comes out. And occasionally, like there was something really bizarre, and I thought I'm going to stick with that and render it, and just that's a version, mm-hmm. you know. And so I was able to pump out like you know, like 20 different designs, and you know, in just a day or so.
Awesome.
And they were all different, unique. So Stan Winston comes around and he goes, okay, I want to see what you've done. He comes in my room and sees what I've done, and he just starts jumping up and down, mm-hmm. so excited. He was like, oh my God, this I've never seen anything like this.
Right.
And it was an interesting process because this went to Steven, and Steven was like, whoever's doing this is designing all the robots.
Nice.
So I designed all the rest of the robots.
Right.
It was a new process. No one was really taking advantage of the using something as primitive as at that time as Softimage mm-hmm. as an animation program as a design tool.
Right.
And so I started using it, and it seemed so fitting and perfect for robots because it was quick and easy, and I could just, especially the type of robots I was designing, I would kind of design them knowing what the strengths were of the program.
Right.
And occasionally I'd experiment beyond that and go, this is going to take too long. maybe I can cheat here in Photoshop or something like that. But it was really exciting and fun. And I was like, and so he was the one that speared me on. And as far as using, you know, these tools as designs, design tools. And of course I was using Photoshop as well. But then I became the lead. I became his art director mm-hmm. from the company. You know, not only helping with the SW Digital, there was also art directing, and many projects came in there that we tried. You know, I started experimenting using these tools, and then ZBrush came along. It was very primitive at the time,
right?
Which is ZBrush is a like a digital clay. Mm-hmm. It's a great program that's as a sculptor, I the only thing I miss from clay is touching it.
You know? Right. It's that other sense we were just talking about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The sense that I wished, you know, that's something that in the computer you can never mimic. Mm-hmm. You know, you need that hands-on. But at the same time, the things that I hated about clay, which is in anything, and this goes back to when I was talking about my childhood of like not having patience with, you know, animation and stop motion, mm-hmm. was symmetry. You know, when I sculpted a character, you sculpt one side and you rough out the other, and then you go, okay, now I've got to spend all this time working on this one side of the, and I've got to make this look exactly like the other side, and it's taking me so long, but I've already done it here, so my brain tells me I'm, you know, to move on somehow.
Right, yeah.
So, I always got through it as a sculptor because it was just one of those things, but that became the work part opposed to the creative part.
Right.
And I know it sounds like kind of a, you know, a petty thing to...
Well, I don't think so. I think you're right. I think you're like... It's like I do everything twice, right? And you had the fun part of the understanding the first part, and it was like, okay, now I just got to do the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Again, it just is a mirror version, and that's got to be tough. And that's right. ZBrush allows that happens automatically.
It does, yeah. And it happens while you're working, you know? Yeah. And then you can turn the symmetry off to make it asymmetrical so it feels more organic. And,
right.
And I do that at the end, and it just, you know, your character's brought to life, and it doesn't feel so digital.
Yeah.
But those tools and being able to... you know, use alphas, you know, which are, you know, just ways of either texturing or sculpting with, just make it even more fun, you know, like in the process, more creative, just and more experimental sometimes.
Sure.
So it's, so this is, you know, after being at Stans for 5 years, and, you know, working and creating, helping with his SW Digital, it was a different time where a lot of makeup effects houses even now have tried to work digital visual effects into their medium and into their other tool sets, and it works on a design level, but it's difficult for the studios to get their head around. So when you pitch, like, you know, I'm Stan Winston, I do, you know, digital. Visual effects, they look at you and go, you're brilliant, you've done, you know, Jurassic Park, but you're not that. How can we change our mindset? So it was very difficult to change that mindset.
Yes.
And I've noticed that recently in a lot of other makeup effects houses that have started up doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I always thought it's a very perfect transition, because these are the people that understand a lot of the grounded aspects of, and what I learned from is all the grounded aspects of what's going to make a visual effects character look more real.
Right.
And it's worked very well at Weta. You know, they've got, you know, there's many talented people that did come from the makeup effects industry. And I think same with ILM. And so it's one of those things that's a hard thing for, I think, the industry and the production and producers to get their head around.
Right.
You know, you have a title. This is what you are. This is what you're known for. How do you change that?
Because they've got a process of departments that they consider, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's something that, obviously, you know, when I was giving your tour, what was your executive producer's name who I was just...
Michael Pecchia.
Michael, nice guy, super nice guy. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that he was talking about is how you guys bridge that gap between the concept area, very early concept, as early as possible, right? And all the way to the creation and the final shots, right?
Yeah.
And that process, I think, is very telling from your history of, like, I started in concept stuff and I understood that, and then I can keep going and going and going, right? You already understood, like, I'm going to start using Softimage. And so, like, wait, that same tool can go all the way to final print, right?
Yeah.
So you guys use a term, and I don't know if I can use it or not. So if I have to cut it out, I'll cut it out. But you guys use a term that's called script to screen. Is that right?
No, sketch to screen.
Sketch to screen.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is your term, and I think it's a fantastic term, but it's like we have the inkling of an idea and we're going to go all the way up to the screen process, right? And I think one of the best descriptions that came for that, which I'd love to talk about because I know our time is limited and I want to make sure we have time about it, is how you guys did that for Stranger Things, because I think that really was a perfect example of how that whole thing came together for you guys. Like the way that it was described in almost an idyllic way actually happened on that project.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's, to jump ahead, you know, so we, you know, left Stans and in 2005 started my own company, the Aaron Sims Company. At the time, now it's called Aaron Sims Creative,
right?
But we kept the ASC.
Uh-huh.
a company seemed a little too corporate.
Okay.
But it was kind of going by Jim Henson Company. And
right, yeah, of course.
And I couldn't call it studio for the obvious reasons.
Right.
If you look at my initials.
Okay. right.
So
you had to have another letter besides that.
Exactly. Yeah. But then I was mainly, started as a designer with my company, just designing for many projects, just started as myself. And then as projects started coming, and which is interesting, if you don't mind me talking about this product,
no.
I can jump back to Stranger Things, is that it was a very interesting part of the industry. Like when I started doing designs on my own,
uh-huh.
because it was a major transition between makeup effects and visual effects.
Yes.
Where there was the studios would like to go to a makeup effects house when they had a script, but they're not quite sure, is this creature going to be a visual effect? Should we go to a visual effects house?
Right.
Why don't we hire a designer to help us figure this out? So uh-huh. that's where I came into this, to where I started, almost perfect timing without planning
and
it.
And you already knew both sides.
So I knew both sides, yeah. So it was the perfect timing for me to start, kind of a unique thing at the time. There's now a lot of concept artists out there, but mm-hmm. It's amazing. 2005 doesn't seem like that long ago, but it kind of was.
That's a lot
changes. Yeah. So yeah, there was a so at that time. Then I would be hired on to figure out, okay, is this character going to be a guy in a suit, or is this going to be a complete CG? So that way we can figure out what that budget has to be, mm-hmm. and then we know which houses to go to. And it wasn't long before it was almost all thinking CG, unless it's like obviously a guy like a horror film with a makeup,
right?
And it slowly changed to where now it's more like, oh, everything's CG now,
mm-hmm.
and it's a mindset that's actually happened in the last several years, and it's become even more so because of so many times that's and where this breaks down, and this is what we try to help here at my company ASC is planning. Planning from the beginning. If it's planned correctly at the beginning, then you can figure out like what is it going to be at the end.
Right.
And so I did that when I started. So I continue that now, but we actually prove it by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, as what I mean is that it's basically working early on with the creatives, the director, the producers that are involved, figuring out what do you want this to be? What is this character creature going to do in your film or TV show? What is its purpose? And let's figure out, the design for early on, and then figure out a methodology throughout the entire process. And that happens from the beginning. So, jumping to Stranger Things,
right.
which was, the Duffer Brothers that directed it, I've worked with them on another project, mm-hmm. Helped them out. It's called The Hidden.
Okay.
And they needed help with designs and some visual effects at the end of that project. This one we were brought on early on at the very beginning, so we were able to help create like what that creature, the Demogorgon, was going to be.
Right.
That was what we were mainly focusing on. We obviously helped with everything, a lot of the other things like the world and the Upside Down, but the main thing was, this creature. It had to be scary. The directors started this whole project, in the mindset, this is bringing back the 80s type of feel.
Yep.
They did it in every way, and I think it was successful with the music, everything that they did.
Mm-hmm.
So even the creature was early thought about, like, hey, can we just do this as a guy in a suit? Because that's what they did in the 80s.
Yep.
Why would we go digital? We don't need to show it off. Like, it's not about showing it off. That's what ruins these type of films or these shows, that when you're trying to get the right scare out of it. And I agreed with them. Mm-hmm. I said, but let's start with the design. Let's figure out what that design is. What's going to be the most effective design for what you're trying to tell with the story?
And you came from that era of horror film as well. You knew about what that was about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff you get for free or accidental on set that you didn't plan on. And
yep.
that's what I think the filmmakers really wanted to have. Mm-hmm. What's different about now is studios don't like accidentals. They don't like those. It's not safe. And so,
and if you rely on it all the time, then it becomes like, really going to get something good?
And those are actually okay when they're independent, short, low budget kind of horror films. You almost, that's your only method, really.
Right.
And you're hoping you're going to get it all because you don't have any money.
Right.
This is Netflix, which, they're investing a lot into new content.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that, you know, they were smart about giving, you know, total creative freedom to the directors, because mm-hmm. That's important, and, you know, telling something unique and not being bogged down with any type of politics that may come through the process. But we helped with, you know, coming up with these, what these creatures were, which I asked him point blank. I go, so what do you see the Demogorgons being? Like, what is this creature? Is it a quadruped? Is it like, you know, is it animalistic? Is it more human? Is it like a guy? Is it like, you know? Mm-hmm. So they basically said, well, think of it like a, you know, it's a thin human creature that is biped, that walks on its hind legs, and it really has no face. It just has teeth and, because it has to devour people, mm-hmm. and that's really it. That's the only information I got. Mm-hmm. So I started to like play around with ideas with him in the room and talk to him about what it could be, and then started almost immediately doing some designs. And with my creative artist around me, we all kind of came up with a variety within 1 week of a bunch of different ideas that kind of spoke to what they were asking about.
Right.
And the designs could go either way. They could go makeup effects or visual effects.
But you had a group of people, and that's a little bit different, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because a lot of people just say, oh, we're just going to hire this great artist, and mm-hmm. we'll have whatever that one person comes up with. You're like, all right, let's just all work together. And this is what I liked about it, because as I was thinking about it, this reminded me a lot of architecture, right? Because mm-hmm. I used to be an architect back in my previous life, and so a lot of times they'll get a group of architects together, or even like they do this in writing as well, like mm-hmm. a bunch of writers in a room and come up with some ideas, right? And you got to sketch, and you play off each other, and you do this and you do that, and you're basically doing something similar to that. You're coming up with a collective idea that sort of, you know, the cream rises to the top in a mm-hmm. lot of ways, right?
Well, that's what we try to do, with, you know, having a series of artists or a variety of different artists that have different skills and styles and a design sense, you mm-hmm. know, because when we work on a project, especially if it's a project I've never worked with a director or even if I have, occasionally I'll do the same thing. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very powerful to be able to allow that director to have many, many choices mm-hmm. early on so that he actually can make a decision. Because a lot of times it is like even before when it was just me, mm-hmm. they'd hire me. They may hire another artist, and occasionally you'd get something, but it took a long time. Mm-hmm. This is I try to speed up the process because there's a longer process that comes afterwards.
Right.
You know, and also again, this comes back to like trying to figure out and planning early on in the process of like what do you want to achieve with this, and if you know really solid direction at the beginning, then you can plan, is it going to be a guy in a suit? Is it going to be a makeup, visual effects? What are the obstacles and the hurdles that come yeah. along with both? Some budgetarily and
some practically, whether yeah. it's going to work or not. Yeah.
So, with Stranger Things, it was, again, it was almost a week. We had, I think it was 15, 20 different designs, mm-hmm. That we submitted to the director, and he fell in love with one that had kind of a flowery face, uh-huh. And that was exciting because it was like it was my favorite as well.
Okay, awesome.
So it was.
Did you do the trick where you have to show all the other ones? Like, I still have this magic one, and you like it.
You know, I've done that before, but no. And this one actually, I actually liked them all, but it was like that was my favorite just because I felt it was the most unique. You know, okay. In a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of ways it reminded me of, you know, still things that, you know, terrify. I mean, something that's exposed teeth. I mean, I always, you know, I go back to Jaws and Jaws, mm-hmm. you know, the one thing when I closed my eyes when I was a kid and I'd get into water and anywhere, it was just the white teeth, like, you know, and my face. That was the only thing I ever saw. Uh-huh. So, you know, having, you know, something that is mainly teeth is always scary. But yeah. also the flowery aspect of it is almost like the Venus flytrap. There's yep. so many elements that derive from that make it.
It's a blend of natural yeah. threats. Yeah.
Yeah. So and that's important, I think, in designing creatures, is that if it's too abstract, if you have no identification of what you're looking at, then it means that you're not going to have an emotion. You're not right. going to feel fear or.
You have to relate to something.
You have to relate to it to mm-hmm. make to create fear.
Yeah.
I mean, this goes back to even Giger. Giger, you know, an alien. It's yeah. like a. As bizarre as that design was, it's still there's so many recognizable aspects of
yes.
that. You know, even the teeth that were the main thing.
Yeah.
Not seeing the eyes again was what was terrifying about that design. But having the teeth and then a jaw that comes out, mm-hmm. and with more teeth that actually bite.
That's like, just horrible.
Yeah. It must be like some kind of like a, I don't know, primal.
But the teeth, like you're right, because those teeth were still like, that's somewhat of a canine teeth, mm-hmm. right? It was something that links it back to like, I've been bitten by a dog before or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah. 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 The teeth weren't like, you know, so bizarre that it's like you couldn't tell what they were. They were they were very recognizable as teeth.
And I think you're right. Like the head of, you know, the demagogue is like, it's like a trap. Like it's freaking, you know, very disturbing because it's a trap that's going to catch you from all sides. And that's happened before, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was interesting because the design was, like I said, it was almost the first week. It was like, okay, that's the design I like. Mm-hmm. Now let's figure out how we're going to make this. And then I said, let's finish designing it. Like let's figure out what does it look like when the mouth is closed? You know, like, and what I try to do with that particular thing is create like a false face. You know, a lot of it started that way.
Right.
So when all the teeth and the petals of the mouth would close, it would create like maybe a false face mm-hmm. that you saw something for a second, but it was in the shape of a head. So mm-hmm. it would all be balanced. So it looked like almost like this very balanced, you know, humanoid, but very lanky, mm-hmm. Long creature. But it'd still be balanced. Because with the head open, there's a slight off balance because of the fact that the head looks bigger.
Right.
That was challenging. That was actually more challenging because it took so many to do that. And I was thinking that if we do a false face, maybe there's something kind of creepy about that. And what I found is that in the process, and this is, you know, again, the genius of these directors is that they really preferred not to have a false face, just have it to where it's like you can't quite make out what it is.
Right.
And I think that's the direction we went when it's closed, is that they're overlapping in a slightly asymmetrical way so that it doesn't really create a face at all. It just becomes this faceless, again, faceless creature, right. which fits, you know, even when the mouth is open. And then it was trying to figure out, okay, is this, because their thinking again was let's do it as a guy in a suit mm-hmm. because I want to, you know, achieve it as you know, what was done in the 80s.
Right.
And I didn't completely oppose to it. I saw and I gave them a lot of the limitations that would happen with it. And went forward creating a guy in a suit. And for a lot of the shots, it actually worked.
Okay.
But then there were shots that were obvious that I knew wouldn't work, where it's coming out of the wall, and the wall is, it's a CG wall, so it has to be. But also when it's pulling out, how do you... you know, how are you going to create that creature that's actually coming out and beyond that and attacking? And
even just opening up the head.
Yeah. And so they tried with, you know, a guy, you know, the guy in the suit. And, you know, that one was most challenging because of, you know, you have this limited mobility of the actor to be able to do certain things as well as you have, like, you're going to have to create a CG wall. So at the time, we were doing like some previs, mm-hmm. you know, for some of the other shots that we knew were going to be visual effects that we were up to do, which was one of those. And I said, well, let's just do the animation and previs of how I see the performance being. And once the directors saw that, then they were like, okay, this is it. This is what it has to be. Now mm-hmm. there's three other shots. You know, let's figure that out. So we end up prevising that entire sequence, and then. At that point, it started to help derive, you know, move forward. Every time it had to break through a wall, or any time it had to do, it was going to have to be us at that point. And that was something that, you know, it's a learning process working with directors that want to do it away, and you're trying to help guide them because mm-hmm. I want to make sure that they're getting everything they want.
Right.
And they do have a method of how they want the performer to be. So we got into the last episode where you really see the Demogorgon. Mm-hmm. That's where, at that point, they had realized it's what all the things it has to do is just going to be us, you know, CG at that point, because there's too many things it has to do. It breaks out of a brick wall. It's like, you know, it's being thrown across a room. It's like it's breaking apart. So like, why mix that at that point and make it more complicated? So we ended up doing all those, you know, CG. And we figured that was going to be the case because when we read the script, we knew that there was just no way
be.
But it was a complete process from the design, you know, sketch to screen. Mm-hmm. And that was a great method that was very successful. And I think for us and for the the filmmakers, because they were able to, we help guide that process all the way through. That's, we're doing that now on other shows too. Working on Stephen King's Mist.
Right.
A TV series.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that's fun. We did a little bit of that and The Conjuring too.
Right.
There was a demon that was in that at the end. So, mixed with a nun and, what we're doing now as we grow is we try to implement this as our method, working as, with the filmmakers early on. And we have been doing more and more helping pitching, with the directors to the studio, by help guiding them a direction that will help, give a studio, everything they need to know about what this film's going to look like, feel like, cost. And, so those are the things that this is what you need to do as filmmakers in this industry is almost when you come with a pitch to a studio, everything's laid out.
Right.
Because to have the studio help with that process and I've experienced that with one of my projects, it can be difficult.
Yep. But if you got it all figured out, it makes this decision so much easier. Right?
Yeah. It's, there's other aspects to our company that we're growing. We're actually getting into training, schooling.
Oh, nice.
We've realized, there's a few schools out there. There's Noman, School of Visual Effects, and they're amazing. Mm-hmm. We actually recruit a lot of their talent here. And what we're doing is we have a certain method that we actually work with, and I think is kind of unique, and we actually feel like we can help kind of give back,
give back to the community.
Yeah.
So that's great. I know we're running out of time, and I don't want to necessarily take up much more, but I'd love to know more about some of the stuff that you guys are doing, obviously, and if there's stuff that's going on the training side of things that we can share with the audience, that would be great to be able to let them know about those things so they can check into it.
Yeah, there's a few. What I can do is there's a couple of things I'm doing right now that I can't talk about because it's with a few people that are also involved with this, which is a different school that's going to be separate. And the only reason is because it's the and you'll hear about it soon. We'll probably be. It's just that we're in the process of development. It wasn't my idea completely.
Sure.
The other school that we're actually doing, we're going to start off as seminars here at the office.
Oh, okay.
Which is a studio based, where they can come in, see how a studio runs.
Right.
And we basically lay out, using a project like Archetype or something like that, from sketch to screen, the entire process. And it's a weekend, and we're going to do it quarterly year, where we basically have, training from looking at a script. When you break down the script, what are you looking for?
Right.
How do you work with the director? And then give basically a task for everybody to design, and it starts on a Saturday, and then they leave at 5 o'clock, and they come back a Sunday with a basic sketch or an idea that we critique and give them.
That's great.
Some,
and they already have the template based on what you guys did in Archetype.
Yeah,
right? So that's awesome.
Yeah, we're starting that. Obviously, I think we're missing the first quarter, but we'll hopefully get into the second quarter this year. But we're going to try to do it quarterly a year. And I think we're going to be using a lot of the artists that actually train as well at Noman, and also they're my lead artists, so they can actually help with that, that process of, what does it take to, how we design, how we actually think about a character that's going to go all the way to CG and be in the film. I'll give you more information on that soon when we actually have that all set
up. Sure. Well, this is, we'll figure out the timing of this. Maybe we can time it so that it comes out around that time. So
yeah.
That'd be cool.
Oh, that'd be great.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. Well, great. I really appreciate your time, Aaron. This has been amazing. I know that it's a lot of stuff that that has always been fascinating me. So I'll stay in touch with you guys. And of course, Kiri's and I have our emails, and she's great. So
yeah,
I'd love to follow up with a lot of the great work that you guys are doing.
There's many more things that we didn't even get into, but our production company.
Well, I can always come back.
Yeah, so we'll do another one.
Yeah, that sounds great.
And, well, Christopher, it's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.